Padataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavatam Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantitami Bhagavad Gita Pavatveshinim.
Start on verse 4, chapter 9.
Maya tatamidam sarvam, maya tatamidam sarvam, jagadavyakta murtina, matstani sarva bhutani, nachaham teshwavastitaha, maya tatam idam sarvam jagat avyakta murtina matstani sarva bhutani nacha aham teshu avastitaha.
Shankara introduces this saying that having gotten Arjuna's attention by all of the praise, right, in the three verses preceding, he's talking about how this knowledge is the greatest of all secrets, is and it is moksha, right? It is liberation from all ashubha, from all everything that's negative. It's the king of all vidyas. It's the king of all secrets. It's the most exalted of purifiers, right? It's a knowledge which is pratyaksha, which is immediate, right? To be immediately recognized. It is very easy to understand. It's very easy to gain, not to understand. It's easy to understand also. It's easy to do, literally. This is easy to do, right? Because there's no distance involved. There's something to know. It doesn't require any action on your part. And so in that way, it's very simple. It's not away from you, and it's avyaya. So these first two verses is all praise of this vidya, of this knowledge. And in the third verse, it was those poor people, the ones who don't have shraddha, you know, who don't have shraddha in this knowledge. For those people, then there's just an endless cycle of rebirth, birth and death. There's endless samsara. And so this is how he begins this chapter, with this type of praise, positive praise and negative praise. But from there, he really moves in. Remember, this is chapter 9. He moves into the heart of this vision, the satya mitya, to the very heart of this vision. So he says, maya tatam idam sarvam jagat. Idam sarvam jagat. This entire universe, jagat is the world. This entire world, everything that exists within duality, the whole manifest creation, maya tatam, it is pervaded by me. Maya is by me. Tatam is pervaded by me. This entire universe is pervaded by me. And then, by me, then he defines himself. By me, the avyakta murtina, by me, by my form, by my nature, which is avyakta, unmanifest. By avyakta, unmanifest, what he means is not the maya upadhi, not the whole manifestation of this creation, but the Brahman, the self, which is the truth of the whole thing, which itself is not manifest in as a name and form, but which is the sat chit. This whole creation is pervaded by me, the sat chit, the me that can't be objectified. So the me that is Brahman, the me that is the conscious being, you know, which is present to the whole creation, but not existing as an object within it. The whole thing, in terms of your own vichara, to recognize your own nature, who you are, so much differentiation has to be done. The differentiation that has to be done is that everything that you can possibly objectify in your experience anything that you can objectify that so that you have a subject-object relationship with it, that has to be differentiated from the subject, who ultimately can never be objectified. The subject can't objectify as an object, the subject. Consciousness can't objectify consciousness. Right? Existence can't objectify existence. Right? It's not a form. Consciousness itself is not a form. We can say consciousness of something, but that's only in relationship to the object. When you get to your being, the conscious being that you are, now we're no longer in the realm of subject-object. If it's in reference to my body, there's subject-object, because through my sense organs, I can objectify the body. Even if I'm sitting in meditation, I can be aware of the body. I can be aware of its shape and aware of all of the movements that are going on in it, on in the physical body. I can be aware of all of the thoughts in my mind, all of my feelings, you know, all of my memories, even the I thought I can be aware of. These are objects. This is what we mean by objectification. But there's always someone left behind. The one who is aware, but you can't be who can't be an object of awareness. The one who is aware, the you that is aware, that can't become an object of awareness. So that one is what we call avyekta. So here Krishna is saying, by me, that self that is avyekta, that can't be objectified. So everything else is mithya, actually. The body, the mind, the sense organs, all of this belongs to the jagat. It all belongs to the creation, and it's all objectifiable. But who you are isn't objectifiable. Now, if who you are isn't objectifiable, it doesn't exist as an object within duality, is basically what you're saying. If consciousness cannot be objectified, it can't be limited as an object in the creation. Once you say that, then whatever there is in the creation, which can be objectified, even the time and the space and the whole creation, that can be objectified, can't touch you. Can't, not only can't touch you, it can't divide you. Which brings us to Advaita. It can't divide you, because it's an object that you're looking at. There's a definite distinction between subject and object. If anything that you're experiencing, if you survive the change, whatever survives a change of experience is not touched by that experience. This is very simple logic. Anything about you as a jiva, your body, your mind, your sense organs, your moods, your emotions, all of the things that go on in this kind of this, you know, emotional, psychological, physical complex, everything that goes on in it is continually modifying and changing. So say you just sit just for a minute to just be aware of your body and your thoughts and your feelings and your emotions. They're in process. They're all in process. There's only one thing that's not in process, and that's the one that's present to the whole thing, that outlasts the change. If you can outlast any moment of change, means the change takes place, but you're still there. Right? It can be, you talk about drastic things like, well, a thought comes into being and goes out of being. Like if I ask you right now, you know, to think of an apple, you probably weren't thinking of an apple. Right? So now you're thinking of an apple. But now I say, please think of a pear. The apple is gone. You had the apple thought came, and it was replaced by the pear thought. Now I say, think of a tree. You probably may have, pretty soon you're going to have forgotten that I'd even asked you to think of an apple. So, apple, pear, tree, flower, rose. One thought, one image replaces the other. When the one is gone, all right, a new one comes, that previous one is gone. It seems silly to even talk about it, but actually it's highly significant because you're not gone. If a perception, an experience, if you can be without any given experience, any given perception, any given emotion, if your being, the conscious being that you are, can be without that experience, then that experience is not intrinsic to you. Why? Because you are and it is not. You know? There's a, in understanding Satya Mitya, there's a, this Anvaya Vyatireka works for this all, for understanding Satyam and Mitya also. Let me just give you the Anvaya Vyatireka again. When this is, that is. And now that shows a relationship. It's the start of a relationship. You know? This is here, that is here. So when this is here, that is here. It's the beginning. Okay, they might be related. You know? This experience is there, that experience is there. So maybe the one is dependent on the other. We don't know. So you have to do the negative. And when this is not there, that experience is not there. And then that shows a dependence. Right? This experience requires this other thing to be there. Right? So they're related to each other. When this is, that is. When this is, isn't, that isn't. So that's very, very important, you know. So what if I were to say there's a real experience between my thought or my emotions and my thought and myself. When this thought is, I am. When this thought goes, I am not. That means I am definitely, you know, dependent. My being is dependent on the thought. But that isn't our experience. Our experience is different than that. We would say, when the thought is, I am. When the thought goes, I still am. Okay? So that shows there's no real relationship in reference to my relationship as the conscious being with the thought. There's no real relationship. On the other hand, because, well, why? Because I'm not dependent on it. If it's here, it's here. If it's not here, it's not here. It doesn't make any difference. I'm still here. But the other way around is not true. Like if I say, when the self is here, the thought is here. When the self is gone, the thought's also not going to be here. Let's look at that just to really get this. This is the Satya Mitya. If I say, like with the rope snake, when the rope is there, the appearance of the snake can be there. Right? The rope can be mistaken as a snake. That's true. Right? So you'd say, when the rope is there, I'd say like this. When the rope is there, taking the Maya into account, when the rope is there, the snake is there. Right? When the rope is gone, the snake is gone. What does that mean? That the rope is totally dependent upon, the snake is totally dependent upon the rope for its being. So when the rope is there, the snake is there. When the rope is gone, right, then the snake is gone. But what if you say, when the snake is there, so let's do it the other way. So that shows a real, you know, that snake totally depends upon the rope, right? Because the rope is there, the snake is there. Rope is gone, snake is gone. So the snake needs the rope. But what if you say now, if the snake is there, right, the snake is there, the rope is there. If the snake is there, the rope is there. So far for sure. If the snake is there, the rope is there. But if the snake is gone, the rope is still there. Right? If the snake is gone, the rope is still there. The rope has no dependence at all on the snake, but the snake is totally dependent for its being on the rope. So that's one. Look at clay pot. When the clay is there, the pot is there. When the clay is gone, say the clay is removed, the pot is gone. Clay is there, pot is there. Clay is gone, pot is gone. Pot is totally dependent on clay because it can't survive without the clay. It has to have the clay. But what if I say, when the pot is there, the clay is there. When the pot is gone, the clay is still there. Like in squash, say we have a lump of clay. I make the lump of clay into a pot. And I don't want a pot, I want a plate. Now I make it into a plate. So now I would say, when the pot is there, clay is there. Right? So there's some relationship. But when the pot is gone, clay is still there. What kind of relationship is it? Satya Mitya. It's where Satya Mitya means for the one to be, the other must be, right? But if that one is gone, the other still is. But it doesn't work in the opposite way. It doesn't work in the reverse. So here, in our situation, when the thought is here, I am here. When the thought is gone, I'm still here. But you can't have a thought without me. So the thought is totally dependent for its being on me, but I have no dependence on the thought at all. My being is totally free of the thought. So the thought is just one thing. My being is free of whatever is objectified. It doesn't make any difference. Whether it be a thought or an emotion or a memory or the physical body or a perception through my sense organs. All of those things are experiences. Right? They're all experiences that we have. But when we say we have, what do we mean? Is my being, the conscious being in which these experiences take place, is my being being changed by the experience? That's the viveka that we have to have. Am I being changed by the experience? Now, what's tricky here is that the experiences I have can be full of affect. Like, say if I have a depressed or an anxious experience or a hurt feeling, you know, the emotions always seem so real. They always take precedence in reality over everything else. But so when I have an emotion, the ahankara, the mind will go, you know, I am sad, or I am hurt, or I am anxious. For the negative ones are the ones we really care about. If we say, oh, I'm happy, that's wonderful, we don't have to comment on it, just let it always be that way. But then it's the negative ones, you know, that are a problem. So rather than recognizing the reality of the experience, I immediately focus on and attach myself to the pain of the experience, because something has to be done about it because it's painful. And so the mind gets totally engaged in trying to remove this experience. But if I were to just stop a minute, what I would recognize is that this experience, in fact, does depend on me. I pervade the experience. I'm the being of the experience. But I am there, perfectly there, 100% there, without being touched by the experience at all. There is absolutely nothing that's happening to me. That doesn't mean that the experience isn't there being experienced. I'm talking about your being. Your being is there as the very substrate reality, or pervade, we'd say, as he said, maya tatamidam sarvam, by me this whole thing is totally pervaded. Totally pervaded. There's no part of any experience that you have that's away from your being. That's away from your being. If you think of just to see in a very simple way how that plays out, if you think with your sense organs, you're aware of this room. And then if you just think what that means, now you're having a perception of this room, everything in the room is known. Right? It is known, it is known, it is known. I'm just talking about the visual from the sense perception. Absolutely everything is known. Any thought modification you have, the entire thing is known, the entire thing is lit up. Right? By who? That being lit up is the conscious being. You're also, and then we say, conscious being. There's another thing. For every experience that you have, everything in that experience, pervasive, is. We don't think about that. But everything in the experience is. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. But actually, the is experience is the am experience. I am. You can't look at is. It is. That's, we're speaking third person. I could say, like, the rug is, or the painting is. Right? I'm not going to say I is. Right? Though that's what I'm going to have to say. The body is. Right? The body is. The rug is. The painting is. All of these things enjoy isness. Except what we have to realize is that the isness is not something that you're perceiving. It's absolutely taken for granted because it is the very substance of the perception. Everything enjoys the isness, but the isness is not an object. So where does this isness, where is it located? It's located in your amness. The isness is the amness. And that amness, I am, that amness, that me, is the being in which all of these perceptions take place, all of these experiences take place. So there's no experience that can be without that non-objectifiable amness. So that non-objectifiable amness, which is isness, right, is the very stable being of all experience that I have. And that's why, since isness pervades every experience is. But the thing to understand is there's a satyamitya there. All these experiences cannot be without beingness, without existence. They can't be. If I take the existence away, they're gone. It's like taking the pot away from the, taking the clay away from the pot. If I take the being out of the experience, it isn't. It's non-existent then. But these experiences don't touch that being at all. That's the satyamitya. Right? The experiences don't touch me. They depend upon me, but they don't touch me. That's why they can go and I still am. So I am, they are. Right? They go, I still am. Whatever experience, I am, they are. They go, I still am. But the reverse isn't true. They are, I am. Right? I go, they can't be here. That's satyamitya. Right? It does not, it's not a two-way street. And so now, in all of my experience, what does that mean? Is that I have to recognize I am the stable one. I am the stable one. And everything in my experience, right, depends upon me. But I'm free of it. And so here, Krishna says, this entire universe, now when you say this entire universe, this entire jagat, what does it mean, just for you as a human being? It means the entirety of your experience. So you say the entire universe, but you think about it for your own personal experience. Everything that I experience. So Krishna says, this entire universe, everything that exists within duality, everything that can be experienced. So from your standpoint, it's everything within duality that I experience, that can be experienced. That is pervaded by me, whose being is avyakta, non-objectifiable. Okay. Then he says, matstani sarvabhutani, all of these beings exist in me, have their basis in me, matstani sarvabhutani, all of these beings, all of these jivas, have their basis in me, have their being in me. Then he says, Nacha aham teshu avastitaha, but I'm not in them. This whole creation, that's the satyamitya, this whole creation, right, rests in me because I am the sat-chit. I am the being that the whole creation is enjoying. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is. That isness is not away from the objects. Right? It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. That's the chit. There's nothing in this creation that isn't pervaded by that. So all of these, all of the entire creation enjoys my being. Right? It rests in me, in existence, and in consciousness. However, I don't rest in them, in the sense that if they go, I still am. And so now this is the Lord talking. This is the Lord talking. But the Lord's talking about, Krishna's talking about the me that is not objectifiable. The me is not, that's not objectifiable in terms of a form, a body, mind, sense organs, anything within duality. That me is you. Because not objectifiable. There's nothing to separate what, when Krishna says this entire creation is pervaded by me. There's nothing to separate that me from you, or from you, or from you, or from you. Because what would separate me? If I'm not objectifiable, what is going to be a dividing line between me and you? Only objectifiable things, like bodies, or minds, or sense organs, or space, or location. All of these things exist within Maya. They all exist within the dream. But you yourself, the being that you are, the me that you are, says Maya, by me, This me is an important word also, because when we think of Satchitananda, you can think of consciousness, a word like consciousness and existence. It doesn't always, these are big words. They don't always land on the very simple personal me that I am. But they have to. That's where these words have to land, or else there's some intellectual thing about some big consciousness I have to reach somewhere. So when we use, that's why he says maya, by me, whose nature, you know, the avyakta, is not something that can be objectified. So he's talking about this me in your own experience, which can't be objectified, which never changes in any way. Now look at it just from your own standpoint, because you don't have the Ishwara Swarupa. Your Swarupa, your nature, in terms of a jiva, your nature is like a jiva in terms of your body, mind, sense organs. The experiences that you have are limited within the Ishwara Swarupa. Swarupa means his nature, the whole manifest creation. You have to think of that in terms of Ishwara. If you think of it, the whole manifest creation, as Ishwara, right? Then this body, these bodies, mind, sense organs, are all part of Ishwara. And so then you're trying to, you recognize that you as a jiva are part of a greater whole. You as a jiva, as an individual, are part and parcel of Ishwara, who has a much greater story. It's an infinite story. It's an infinite manifestation of infinite knowledge in which you are in a part of the warp and woof of that story, the story of Ishwara, the projection of infinite knowledge. So your body, mind, sense, organs, mind, we're all part of that. So that's something this is something extremely important to understand, because then I understand this body, mind, sense, organs is part of a conscious being, which is myself. The conscious being is myself, but is part of an infinite projection of knowledge, this creation, which has that conscious being as itself. And so this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishwara. It belongs to Ishwara, you know. It's just like these fingers belong to the hand, and the hand belongs to the arm, and the arm belongs to me, right? So every part of this body, right, belongs to the whole and is taken care of by the whole and is a member of the whole. So everything, when this is Ishwara's body, this infinite creation, Ishwara's infinite creation, infinite mind, these are all part and parcel of it. And so the one self which illumines this body, mind, sense organs is the one me that illumines the whole Ishwara, the whole creation. You know? And so as I understand that, I become much more relaxed in this creation to just do my part in it. Let's see how it unfolds. But how does this creation unfold? What is the story? What is my story in this creation? It's all Ishwara. And Ishwara has for its being you. So Ishwara is not somebody foreign. Right? You are Ishwara, in fact. In the real sense of it, you are Ishwara. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being from which the whole manifest creation comes. That manifest creation includes this body, mind, sense organs. And so now, say, as you gain knowledge, you're looking around, it's like you're walking through yourself. You are Ishwara, and now as you are a jiva within the Ishwara who you are. You as a jiva are in Ishwara who you are. And so this is a different level of understanding, because when I understand this, then I can trust in Ishwara, because Ishwara is infinite knowledge. And I am the self. It is Ishwara is me. And so here we get ourselves into these big messes and, you know, complex situations. We have no idea what to do or what's going to happen. You know, but say a jnani will very often just be kind of patient and see how the thing plays out until your part, you know, it becomes your part in the situation becomes obvious. Once your part becomes obvious, because it's time for you to act, you know, then you take the obvious action or make the obvious choices. The jivatvam gets in our way, though, because we can project into the future before the future has arrived. We project into it, you know. When we don't have all knowledge, so we don't really know what's going to happen, you know, but we project, and then we live in that projection and suffer. So we spend so much time living in the jiva's projection. You know, having, because you know, it's the same thing. You know, if you see a snake on a rope, you don't see the rope. You don't see a snake on a rope. You see the snake. So your reactions are toward onto the snake. So say it's. Well, so what I'm saying is, your emotional life is triggered by how you're, what you're thinking, you know? So if you're projecting into the future, you know, and you're seeing a catastrophic thinking, you're experiencing that catastrophe and the emotions that go along with it and kind of the fear and the worry and the dread. Whereas for a jnani, somebody who, as you become rooted in your knowledge, one of the bennies or one of the things that makes life easier is you start being not allowing for all of that projection, pulling back the projections and being more interested in watching how these things are unfolding, knowing that when it's time for you to act, you'll have what you need to make that decision. You know, or you have the tools that you need to handle that situation. That all has to do, these are all the wonderful things, the kind of the gifts that we get as we come into relationship with Ishwara, where the body, mind, sense organs are given over to Ishwara. Well, that's a beautiful thing. It's a different order of reality, though, than what I'm trying to talk about right now. Right now, it's really understanding how when Krishna says, this entire creation is pervaded by me, who am avyakta, who am unmanifest, cannot be objectified. That is Krishna's experience as Ishwara. He says, this entire creation, because as Ishwara, the self illumines and reflects off of the entire manifest creation. It's like an infinite thought, you know? And so Krishna, talking as Ishwara, will say that this entire infinite creation is pervaded by me. The entire creation and all beings have their basis in me, Matsthani. They all exist in me, but I don't exist in them. Okay? So that's Ishwara talking, right? With the whole Maya Upadi. Now, you have to look at that. What does that mean for you? Because you are the same. You are the same self when he says Maya, by me, the avyakta. There's only one me. There's not two. There's only one me. But now for your upadi, as an individual upadi, you don't have the experience of the entire jagat, of the entire creation. So you're not going to say, this entire creation is pervaded by me, in terms of your immediate experience. Right? That's Ishwara's experience. Ishwara, the whole experience is replete with consciousness. It's an infinite mind. But now, your experience is the same, in a sense, from your vantage point. Because here, this, what you experience, this is Ishwara. It's your little piece of Ishwara that you experience from your sense organs and your mind. Right? So now, this is your sarvamidam jagat. See what I mean? This is that for you. Right? This, so I could say as an individual, this entire creation that I experience, even though it's not Ishwara, Ishwara is infinite, but this is mine, the entire jagat that I experience, right? So my karma, my prarabdha, all the experiences that come to me, all of these experiences, without exception, are pervaded by me. Every experience that I have, every experience is pervaded by me. By me, who is the me? By me, by the self, which is avyakta. By the consciousness, which itself, the conscious being that I am, which itself can't be objectified. Right? I can't look at me as an object, but I pervade every object. There is no experience that I have that doesn't have me as its basis. In fact, every experience that I have, right, is. I pervade it with my isness, with my beingness, and with my consciousness. There's no experience that you have that's away from consciousness, or you wouldn't know about it. There's no experience that you have that's away from existence, or it wouldn't be there. If it's away from existence, it will not be there. You pull the existence out of it, it's gone. That's the satyam nitya. But this sat-chit that I am, everything in this creation enjoys it, has it for its being. And it itself can't be objectified, but it enjoys me completely. But now he says, that's all true. It enjoys me completely. This whole creation, all beings, have me for their self. But I'm not abiding in any one of them. And you have to say, you know, is the rope abiding in the snake? Is the rope abiding in the snake? From the rope standpoint, there isn't even a snake, actually. You know, the snake depends on the rope, but the rope is completely free. That's one. Another interesting one is this. The pot totally depends upon the clay for its being. I am its truth. As clay, I am its truth. Right? It abides in me. Right? Yeah. And I am the avyekta clay that has no form. The avyekta clay pervades the whole pot. The unmanifest clay doesn't have a form. The pot's the form. That unmanifest clay, it totally pervades the whole pot. And the pot, right, is rooted in the clay. It depends upon the clay for its being. That's the matsdhani. It depends on me for its being. But then he says, but as the clay, he says, you know, I don't depend on the clay. You can even say, and we'll say later, and you know what? I not only don't depend on the clay, I don't depend on the pot, you know. In a sense, there is no pot. There's only me. But there is a pot, but there is no pot. Right? And so we have to see this in the creation, in our creation. Our creation means here we are, our series of experiences. Every experience, once you get to the relationship of myself, consciousness, that's the avyekta, you know, which is the same self that Krishna's talking about. Even though I am a jiva within Ishwara, from the standpoint of me, of the conscious being that is my truth, my experience is the same as Ishwara's. Where is there a difference? Where's there a difference? Because the one self that Krishna is referring to, that self, that consciousness, which is not objectifiable, that self in truth pervades the entire creation and everything in it. Everything in it. Because this is all included, and this is a piece of the entire creation. So that self pervades all of it. So then, that being so, wouldn't that also be my experience? In this little piece of creation, that myself pervades all of it. You have to remember that myself, Krishna uses this, mama atma, he says myself, and then the question is, what my? What myself? Who's the my? And then Shankara writes about that, and he says, he's just talking from convenience. I'm talking from the standpoint of my body, myself. But that self, which is avyekta, is not objectifiable. There's only one such self, and that self is the self that pervades the whole creation. Now, from my standpoint, it means that self, which is me, pervades my mind, my sense organs, my body, and everything that is perceived. There is no experience, whether it be a dream state, an imaginal experience, an active imagination, you know, a memory, no matter what emotion might be there, it doesn't make any difference at all. Whatever is there, I am there pervading it as its truth. That's one thing. I'm there pervading it, and without me, it couldn't be experienced. and I'm not touched by it at all. So now the thing is, this has to be recognized. And it has to be recognized by your mind. From the standpoint of consciousness, there isn't a problem, right? Consciousness, the conscious me, the me, has no problem illumining a miserable thought. It doesn't care. I'm always the same. I will illumine and pervade whatever is there. If it's a miserable thought, it's an agitated thought, an angry thought, or a happy thought, or a compassionate thought, you know, or just an intellection, or just a perception, it makes absolutely no difference. I equally am present to all of it. And I have no attachment. It doesn't make any difference. I will give fully of myself that I am without having to do anything at all except just be myself. I give fully to every experience that is there. I'm the truth of every experience that is there. But none of them touch me. It's like the sun. They use the sun so much as an example in the Shastra. The sun is shining, bright, brilliant sun, as it is shining on a thunderstorm. A thunderstorm with a torrent of rain. And it's shining down on that thunderstorm, nicely illumining the clouds. It is illumining the thunderstorm. And this thunderstorm is creating all types of floods and racket and everything. The sun just illumines it fully, completely. There's no problem. It isn't being affected by thunderstorm. Now the clouds clear. Now the same sun is now shining upon, you know, the flooded lands. And now those are being illumined. That doesn't make any difference at all for the sun. It's not like, oh no, it's, yeah. Oh dear, I'm here, I'm illumining a thunderstorm, you know. Oh, look at those floods, oh dear, oh dear. Has no problem whatsoever. It is what it is. And it doesn't become one way or another, dependent upon what's being illumined. You know? And so I'm like that too. It's not about being indifferent, you know, in a negative way. It's just your nature. Your nature is pure, conscious being. Nobody can touch it. Nobody can change it. It's full and complete in and of itself. And it is the reality that pervades all experience. And that reality is you, which pervades all experience, can never be touched in any way. And so that is moksha. That's the moksha. You know, then, you know, so I remember so much Swamiji when he would be teaching all of this. And one of us would invariably say, but Swamiji, you know, what about my mind? What about my mind, you know? You know, what about my thoughts and everything? My feelings and all of that? What about that? And that's a legitimate question from the standpoint of the mind and the pain, how the mind can produce pain and all of that type of stuff. But what if you were to say that to the sun, you know? Like, if you were to say, what about the thunderclouds, you know? Shouldn't those thunderclouds not be there? Shouldn't there not be? There shouldn't be so much rain, don't you think? You know? Oh, what does the sun care? You know what I'm saying? It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant to your being. And that needs to be understood in order for the mind to have a home base. You know, to really have a home base that is free. The self is yourself. Let's say this. This is a little bit of an unconnected segue, but I want to talk about it for a minute anyway. Yourself is the one who is whole and free and good. That is your nature. You are whole, you are free, and you're good. Because that's benign. That's the nature of the Atman. You know? By good, I mean there is nobody that you would rather be with than that being. The being that is you. It's dharmyam. You know? the being that is you is the one who this entire creation manifests, the entire Dharma, all of the laws of the creation. You know, the whole Dharma is rooted in your being. That being is pure and is good. Within relativity, the body, the mind, the sense organs, my moods, my emotions, my relationships, the things I say, the things I do, are sometimes good. Sometimes good. Sometimes not so good. They're not always good. We do our best. In this relative world, we try to follow Dharma. We try to be good. You know, we have a value for being good. We have a value for being kind. We have a value for being giving. All of these things. You know? And sometimes we are and sometimes we're not. And that's reality. You know? That's why it's hard to be a saintly person. You know, a saintly person is saintly realizing that they have a lot of this shortcoming and this shortcoming and that shortcoming. So if you're going to, it's kind of hard to be perfect within relativity. It is very difficult to be a perfect person within relativity, within the relative world of Dharma and Adharma. This is really such an important thing to understand, because even Swamiji, to me, who is my absolute role model completely, part of what's included in that is his ability to be with his mistakes. It's certainly not that he doesn't make them. He would never say that. He would never say that. But then, how are you with that? Who has made the mistake? Who has made the mistake? Have I made the mistake? Has the sin made the mistake? Has the Atma made the mistake? In fact, the only one that hasn't made the mistake and doesn't make mistakes is yourself. I'm not trying to condone making mistakes. So just don't worry about it. Just make mistakes. We pay a price for the mistakes. We pay a big price for any kind of adharma. Now, those are part of the laws, just like we pay a big price for putting our hand in fire. Just on a physical level. We pay a big price for eating the wrong food. I mean, we pay big prices for hundreds of countless things. We pay big prices for saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. We all pay the price, whether you're a swami or, you know, a Jivan Mukta, you know, or just a mumukshu, or just an ordinary person. We all equally are paying big prices. And big rewards also for the things that we do that are just at the right time, say just the right thing at the right time, do the right action at the right time, or dharmic and all of that. That's also beautifully rewarded. But, you know, the freedom, that arena is not free. Because that arena of the world takes continual maintenance. And we do the best that we can. Continual maintenance. But there is one person who is free. That is the self. Your self is free. Your self doesn't have to worry about being adharmic. The self, just fully and completely, with all the love, natural love of its being, just illumines nicely your adharma and the results of it. And it illumines equally nicely, without any judgment, the good things that you've done also. That one is not subject to dharma and adharma. That's why in the Upanishads, like in the Katha Upanishad, Nachiketa asks, is there anything, any place I can go that's free from dharma and adharma? So this is what's asked in the Upanishads. Is there any place which is free from dharma, adharma? Because it's just impossible. You know? We do our best, but you can never be perfect. You know, not going to be perfect. So you have to, if you want that perfection, you have to go to where it is, which is the Atma, the self. And so as we get tangled up in the samsara here, you know, in our shortcomings, and then trying to correct them and to be better and do good, which we are going to do, That's just part of being human, being a human being, you know? We're always trying to be in harmony with Bhagavan, and we're failing in this way and that way. But all the while, there's the one inside who is good, period. Who is completely good, completely full, completely free. And so when we get ravaged by these concerns of dharma and adharma, and if I haven't lived up to this or haven't lived up to that, you really just have to go home. You have to go home to your own being where the goodness really lies. Yeah. I don't often quote the Bible, but there was something that Jesus said once that I only recently thought, oh my gosh, I wonder if he meant that. He said, somebody was praising him as being good. Remember, anybody, Christians, remember that? Somebody was praising him as being good. And he said, nobody's good. Nobody's good, only the Father is good. No one's good, only the Father is good. And that's true. Is it, only the self is good. The self is good, it will always be good, and that self is you. So that's where one has to, you know, abide. And as one, as a mind, as your mind just abides there, you know, then, you know, we are not impelled to do a dharma as a human being. When you have found the fullness of yourself, you're not impelled to do, you're not impelled or what do you call it?
Compelled.
No. You know, it's like when, there's a word I want, but I can't think of it. When there's something that you really want.
Motivated?
No, almost. It's when you really want something, you know? And so you're enticed in a way by enticed by an adharmic action, right? Because you really want that, to be happy. Mm-hmm. It's not a joke, first. I'm sorry. I need this to be happy. And there's the little adharmic teasers, you know, that, well, maybe I could have that if only I, you know, if I did that. And that happens to be a dharma, and sometimes I'll succumb to it, you know. That succumbing, you know, is because of that projection of my ananda on that, even speaking crossly. When we speak crossly to a person, it's because somehow my happiness is being impinged upon by the behavior of that person. And so I can be angry, especially, you know, in your relationships and with your partners and things. You can get very annoyed because why? Because what they're doing could take away some of your happiness or some of your security, you know? And so these type of projections are there all over the place for us. And then we behave in ways that we wouldn't behave if we didn't feel threatened. And we feel threatened because I projected myself onto something out there. And that's how it is. That's what happens. And so for somebody who's gaining anishta in this knowledge, you keep pulling all of that stuff back. With your knowledge, you pull, you bring your mind back home. You know, that's because naturally it's going to, for some years or for some time, it's going to be behaving in that way, in the way that it's behaved for beginning those lifetimes. You get some knowledge and then everything's supposed to just hop into place. It doesn't. You pull it back with your knowledge. That's a little bit different what I'm saying, though. What I'm saying here is that in the midst of all of these experiences that you're having, the you is free. There's someone there who is free, completely free. Right now. Completely present, completely free. It just needs to be differentiated. And then you realize that there is no experience that's not pervaded by that completely free self. And that all of the experience that you have rests in that self. And that self is not touched in any way by those experiences. That's why you're free. Because yourself, no experiences are away from you. They all depend upon you. You pervade all experiences, but at the same time, you're totally free. And not touched in any way, actually a sangha, you know, not touched in any way by those experiences. So this isn't just a belief system that Upanishads are talking about. The reality of your experience, it just has to be differentiated. You have to recognize it. That's why the Upanishads are going over and over in this way. So this verse and the next two verses, which will be next week when I come back, are the Satyam Mithya verses, three in a row. Yes. I guess it's really an amazing chapter. You know, it's all Satyam Mithya, to recognize your being as the stable, changeless truth of all of your experience. And that being is whole and complete and free and remains untouched. So in that way, your negative and painful experiences are very important in terms of Vedanta, in terms of gaining Nishta. Because even in your most negative experience, that self is there completely untouched. So when you're freaking out, having a negative, overwhelming experience, you should have some little mantra where you say, oh, here's one, here's an experience, here's the experience. Now, let me see if I can recognize myself in the midst of this, you know, stormy weather. Can I recognize myself? Which is there, totally uncovered. It's not as though the stormy experience covers me. It doesn't cover me at all. It's like the sun is never covered. The sun is the sun. You know, it's illumining whatever experience is there. When we use that example, we're not talking about somebody standing on the earth on the other side of the rain, looking up at the rain clouds and then saying, oh, it's so rainy, the clouds are, they're blocking the sun. That a person would say that, right? Say if there's a big stormy weather and there's a person on the ground looking up at the storm and getting, you know, soaked with light thunder and lightning, and they're looking up, and they would even say, you know, I know the sun is there, but I can't experience it. Right? I can see, I know that it's there because I can see the storm clouds and experience the storm clouds, but the storm clouds have to go away for me to see the sun. That's what we think when we hear that example, but that's not what it means. Because you're the sun. You are the sun. And the sun and the rain cloud, the sun is not covered by the rain clouds. The sun illumines the rain clouds. But the sun isn't touched by them at all. And it's exactly the same thing. Your being in total, in its entirety, remember it's non-dual, so it doesn't have an up or down or right or left, but yourself is not covered at all in any way by the stormy mind. But you need that viveka. And I'm not saying we want a stormy mind either. I'd rather just have a nice sunny day. That's true, but that's different. That's true also. I might prefer the sunny day instead of the stormy mind. But that's not the point. The point is whether it's a stormy day or sunny day, yourself is there totally present without being touched in any way by whatever kind of day it is, whatever kind of mind it is. That's the viveka. That's why you should use the negative experiences to just say, okay, stop, let me see if I can recognize that, the truth of that. Yep. Now, that is exactly the same situation when you're having a happy day. Your mind is happy. Maybe it's even blissful. That doesn't mean the self isn't blissful. The self is ananda. Because look, you think, oh, I'm having a bliss experience now. Then you can say, oh, I'm finally seeing myself. No, you're having a bliss experience. Your mind has a shanta vritti, you know, and it's as though reflecting yourself in a certain way, and you know, it's having an experience. But that bliss experience can go away. So it's not you. You don't go away. So you're not the one, you're not the state of sorrow, and you're not the state of bliss. You're the state of ananda, the ananda which cannot be defined by any experience that you have out here that's coming and going, whether it's a blissful experience or a depressed experience. The ananda, which is yourself, is unique to the self. It doesn't mean that it's not full and whole and complete. It's just the word ananda has to land on your own nature for you, because it's not an experience that comes and goes, whether positive or negative. It's the very self that is present to those experiences. So another good thing to do is when you have a little bliss or happy experience, say, okay, wait a minute, let me just have some viveka there between my being and this blissful experience. The blissful experience is more resonant with my being, you know. But I can make the differentiation between these, the satchitananda of me and the blissful experience of the mind. And then I can see that that satchitananda, which is me, is exactly totally present in all of my experiences. And that's a very good exercise for the mind, because the mind starts to recognize its home base. And then more and more enjoys just staying home and experiencing the world from the constancy and stability of that fullness. It just requires us working on it in the sense of not going to the gym, but working on it in the sense of seeing the truth of it over and over, you know, recognizing it. So contemplation and good, this kind of unfolding is good also. Okay, let's take just a moment. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Teachings of Vedanta, or the teachings of non-duality.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, excuse me, we say Advaita Vedanta.
Yeah.
So why is that? Is that word added because there's some teachings that say that they cite the Upanishads as their authority, but they're not really non-dual teachings?
Like Dvaita, there's Advaita Vedanta. When we're looking at the darshanas, darshanas are the philosophical systems in India. That's what. Vedanta doesn't take itself to be a philosophical system, but when we look at these six major philosophical systems that accept the Vedas as authority, as pramana, in the Advaita Vedanta, there's Advaita Vedanta, then there's a Dvaita Vedanta, and a Vishishta Advaita.
See, Vishishta Advaita, but is that Vishishta Vedanta really? Or that's, because I've heard Vishishta Advaita, and I thought, wait a minute.
Well, they I don't remember what they all say, but it's something like this, that the Dvaita just definitely sees a difference between you and Ishwara. It's, and they base it on the Upanishads by breaking a sandhi in a particular way, like atat tvam asi, something like you are not that. You're a tetramasi or something like that, you know. And that's just pure Dvaita. It hasn't stood really the test of time, or it hasn't. But nevertheless, that philosophical system is there. Vishishta Advaita sees this. It sees, you know, if I take the wave ocean example, it'll seem like this. The waves are part of the ocean. The jiva is part of Ishwara, right? You know, but But there's some sort of a duality mm-hmm. between the water mm-hmm. and the wave ocean. There's some sort of a qualified Advaita. So these are different schools, mm-hmm. really just really for argumentation.
Right. But they actually cite the Upanishads.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's what. Thing. See, with the Vedanta means end of the Vedas. So for the Advaita Vedanta, the Upanishads mm-hmm. are the Pramana. Right? Then in Mimamsa, the Karmakanda, the first part of the Vedas are the Pramana. You know, from that's all concerned with rituals and what the first part of the Vedas are saying, the different lokas and all of that, but mostly an analysis of the rituals. Then there's the Sankhya Yoga, which accept the Vedas also. But whereas the Mimamsa and the Advaita Vedanta depend totally on the Upanishads or on the Karmakanda, on that knowledge which is given there as a pramana, as the authority. Sankhya Yoga accepts the Vedas as pramana, but they believe that they through logic they can establish their own position. Advaita Vedanta doesn't accept that at all. That you can't establish Advaita without the pramana of the Upanishads. Sankhya Yoga doesn't feel that way. And then the Vishishta and Nyaya, these two go together and they have a whole another cosmology. You know, but they too accept the Vedas. So.
I thought Nyaya.
The Nyayakas are logicians. But they accept the Vaisheshikas. The Vaisheshikas and Nyaya kind of accept each other, like Sankhya and Yoga team up. And Vaisheshikas use the logic of the Nyaya. Nyaya means logic, the Nyayayikas. And the Nyayayikas accept the philosophical position of the Vaisheshikas. These are called the Darshanas. Advaita Vedanta, from its own standpoint, doesn't really see itself as a darshana or belonging to that system. But then people from outside, like academics and scholars, will put it in with those systems, you know. That's a big study.
Yeah.
Well, a particular situation drives you to... to a place where you can't hold it anymore. You know, it psychologically makes sense because your emotions are so overwhelming, right?
Yeah.
And you never had one, you know, you never had one like that before. You know, you had an experience before that was pretty bad, right? Or not bad, but it was not preferable. And then you have another one that you couldn't even compare to the last one you had. And it's because of the teachings that I had, that there's something organically that came and looked at the situation, that just held the situation unconditionally, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't know it would be that difficult. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, we want bliss, right? I mean, at least I do. I prefer bliss more than the anguish of certain yeah. things, you know? But I also start to notice that, like, even the wanting the bliss is just as much of a trap as...
It is, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because then you have to hang... If that bliss or joy is something that's born of something in the creation, then you have to protect it, you know, and it's pleasurable. So, you know, sukha, dukkha, pleasure, pain. I'd rather have pleasure.
The avoiding of pain and the attachment to pleasure.
But see, at some point you'll realize, and probably do throughout, that the ananda, the very nature of the self, the wholeness, the kind of the sanctity of it, the ananda of that is more desirable than anything in the creation.
Yeah, but it also doesn't mean that once you have seen, have been the unchanging present, also in the situation of total chaos, so to speak, that doesn't mean that after the storm settles,
uh-huh.
that doesn't mean that you try to improve that particular situation, you try to work with, have relative peace, right? Really.
I think that anything that causes pain to the mind or the body is kind of like a signal. You know, if something's causing pain, it's a signal. It's saying, help me, you know, help me here. And so it wants attention, right? Yourself is free, but you're getting a signal from your mind or from your psyche or from your body saying, you know, this needs some care. And it's only natural to go and try to care for it.
Even though you have seen that that's not who you are.
Even though.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because it belongs
bypass,
to the mind.
Yeah. That's the bypass.
That's bypass.
Intellectual.
That bypass will catch you in the end. Because you're just trying to shove it in the closet somewhere, and, you know, get some bigger locks on the door, you know. But if there's something that's causing pain, the best thing is to just be with it and be curious and helpful, you know, wanting to be with that, wanting to understand it, wanting to help. Just like in the world, you know, you're not gonna. You wouldn't probably want to do emotional bypass to others. You know, like say somebody's hurting or in pain, you know, then you would want to be there. You're in a situation to help or to talk or do what there is to be done, right? To help that person. That's just normal. But that same thing has to be there toward ourselves too, for the different moods and emotions and problems and complexes. It should be an attitude of wanting to help. And if that attitude of wanting to help or hold or is not there, then there's some sort of anger or something else that inside that has to be dealt with. You know, like say somebody is there that needs some help. You know, and they're calling on you for some help. I'm not trying to make a big complex situation, just kind of the natural day-to-day stuff. Then you help. You don't really think about it, you just help. Do your best with that situation. And that's natural. You don't really probably even notice it or think about it. But that same type of natural wanting to help should be internal also. Like if there's some part of you inside that is hurting or angry or, you know, bitter or whatever painful emotion is there, what is your attitude toward it? Is it to help, to understand, you know, or is it to be like a negative parent to it? That's that self-talk, why it's so important to see. How are you to yourself internally? What kind of self-talk is there?
But you know, if you have this stable self and there's some storm going on that's really bad, it seems to me also that just sort of like going to that it's the same thing in a sense. You're being kind to yourself. Just go to that self and, you know, let the storm do its thing, you know.
That's true too. Sometimes that is what you will naturally do, but sometimes the storm's too big.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
When the storm's too big, because otherwise you'll just hold it with yourself and it'll pass, and you don't need to get engaged with it. You don't need to. Sometimes you need to, you know, because it's like a complex inside, or it's like a child inside that actually needs some sort of relationship to allow that to grow and become free. It's causing too much pain to be able to let it be like that. So you have to have, you know, it's like a toolbox. You have to know what to do in different situations, yeah. You know, the different problems that come up. And it's the same with people in your life. Like sometimes somebody's upset or something is wrong and there's nothing to do. You can just wait for it to pass. It doesn't require any big psychological discussion. You can let it pass through. That's fine. Sometimes it's not like that. It needs more attention. And all the while yourself is there holding it. but there is dealing in Vyavahara, empirical reality. You know, we have to handle the situation.
So is psychotherapy primarily, I mean, I know there are lots of different angles of how to approach psychotherapy, but is it primarily kind of rearranging the relationship of the person to mitya in order to make the person function better in mitya? Because satyam isn't really...
Satyam has
unless
a problem.
It's transformative psychology or whatever, you know, where that is touched, or I don't know. But I'm just saying satyam is kind of not really the terrain.
No, it isn't. But it's once the viveka is there, then that's a great blessing for the mind, because that stable self is always present. But you know how, like, it's obvious if something happens to your body, if your body becomes sick or something, mm-hmm. you do what's required to make it more pain-free, mm-hmm. you know, to make it healthy. And that's what we try to do with the mind also, mm-hmm. to cure it of its whatever it is that's causing pain. One of the most important ways, I think, to do that is to look at the self-talk. Because, you know, we internalize our childhood experiences, and we have self-talk that is, even from a young age, is just what we're used to. Mm-hmm. We're just used to it. We don't even think about it. We don't even think that there's kind of a mean father inside, or, you know, or a nagging mother or whatever. We don't think about it. But that's
just happening.
It's just mm-hmm. happening all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, but if you point it out, you know, then that inner self-talk can become much better, much more positive. And then that creates an environment where a lot of other things can be worked on then.
Carol, do you think as you go, I mean, I was wondering about this today, and I really have no idea, but do you think, like, sometimes as you sort of go along in this knowledge and all that, sometimes, like, just like more really terrible stuff comes up, and you know, I mean, it just seems like
from underneath.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you think that's true?
Yeah. You know why? You know why that happens? Huh. It happens in therapy also, but in therapy, there's a similar process. In therapy, if you have a deep relationship, a strong therapeutic container, and you have a good relationship with a therapist, then there's the psyche. And the defense system is bolstered by your presence, by the presence of two of you. Now it's two of you, you know, that can hold the stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the psyche, well, its defense system will open up a little bit more, so that some of the stuff will come out that you normally would not let yourself look at.
Actually, now I remember Swamiji saying something like that. That your mind relaxes, and then
this. And in Vedanta, as you start to realize there's a stable container there, the mind relaxes, and then you'll get whatever stuff is lurking in there that needs to be released, and it's causing you pain.
But do you think? I mean, maybe I'm a paranoid or something. But do you think sort of like Ishwara? Himself or herself or whatever actually kind of like brings these things to you in a way? I mean, not just like they're just coming up from inside, but somehow there's like outside situations that seem to be provoking
on
this.
It seems that way sometimes. But you know that how that example I use that for that? Because it does seem like that. It's like you just couldn't provoke, you couldn't make it. Give me a harder situation, and then now you're doing it again. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But I think of it like this. So sometimes I do feel that there's something like that going on. It's just too personal. It's all for your own growth, but whatever you want to say. But anyway, what I was going to say. You know how when you want to buy a car, like I remember when I wanted to get a Volvo many years ago. When I decided to get a Volvo, then I was driving along, all I ever saw were Volvos. You know? Mm-hmm. So say there is something niggling there. The triggers are everywhere. They're everywhere. But if you don't have the problem, you know, to be triggered by that, those events, nothing happens to you. But if you have that particular problem, then there's so many opportunities to trigger that. That's one thing. Another thing is your own prarabdha karma. That's right. Remember Jagadish online? Yeah, yes. I'm gonna use this story again. You know, remember at the, when we were at the airport and some guy, the guy who was doing the bags gave Jagadish such a hard time. It was really awful. You know, for no reason. I mean, no reason we knew of. Gave him such a hard time. At the end of it, Jagadish just kind of put his hands in a prayerful position and said, "Whatever I did to you in the last life, please forgive me." But you know what? I think that there are karmas. You know, there are karmas that have to be worked out. You know, that there's people in your, or situations in your life that are there just to torture you. And you have to be able to say, whatever I did to you in the last life, please forgive me. You know, kind of like that Hawaiian healing method, that Hanumanopia or whatever it's called.
I've never heard of
that. Oh, you haven't?
No.
It's kind of, I won't tell that story. But, you know, that seems uncanny sometimes, that somebody will show up that is just kind of meant to create pain for you. And it's uncanny. So when it's like that, then you can think, last life. They've come back. They must have done something really bad.
It seems like they're, you know, like in relationships, there's a possibility that they're incompatible pain bodies, if one wants to maybe call that, that, you know, and then you can call it prarabdha karma. You can call it all these different terms and different modalities, but fundamentally it boils down to you just can't find the alignment or something, you know, because it's just on a psycho-emotional level, you know? I mean, how much therapy you do,
you won't find
how much you understand Advaita Vedanta or Vedanta or any of these tools, you can actually, they might be totally present. You know, I remember some of these situations where I could totally see certain things, you know, in my last relationship, and they still happened. You know, it was just like watching my own movie, like, and being like these different actors in the same movie at the same time, simultaneously, without actually being able to change the direction of the movie. And that was kind of shocking. I understand this more now, because if you really look from that perspective of Satyam, there's a certain kind of astonishment that comes when you realize you can't stop this unfolding that is so... so core root chakra survival based stuff.
That's I know, but I mean, you know, knowledge can be really so helpful there, because you watch this scene unfolding that's really a very difficult scene and you can't stop it. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. But then you can have a different type of way to be with it. Mm-hmm. You know, be free inside even though the situation is not a happy one.
And it's like watching that car wreck. Mm-hmm. You can see it, you know?
Yeah. Not all the situations that are happy, and you can't change them all either. You can always change them.
So it's like
but
this.
But the sun is shining.
There was a poem that my sixth grade teacher used to. It's called Casey at the Bat. You ever heard that?
I think I have, actually.
It ends like that. Somewhere the sun is shining, somewhere people shout, but there's no joy in Mudville because Casey, mighty Casey, just struck out.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I can't believe I remember
that. Yes. But I've asked this many times before, but I'm still not clear. When you speak about thought modification, what is that?
That's a translation of vritti, or antikarana vritti. Right. So... a thought you don't have to say, we're used to saying thought modification, right? Because that's what Swamiji always says. Antakarana means the mind, and vritti means like a... Vritti actually means like an activity. But when we talk about activity in reference to the mind, it's a thought. So whether the thought is a perception or an emotion, so I'm using thought in a general way. There's a perception, there's an emotion, there's a memory. Those are all thoughts.
Right.
So the different things that go on in the mind, those are all thoughts. They're all vrittis.
So what does the word modification mean then? Why
it's like
is that word?
Because if you say antakarana vritti, a modification, thought modification, it means the thought stuff goes on changing and changing and changing.
Oh, that's the modifying. Yeah.
That's the modifying.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a little, the language, when I'm so used to it as being how Swamiji talks about antakarana vritti, but when you look at the language thought modification, what is that?
What is avyakta? What does it translate into?
Unmanifest.
Okay.
And so there's two levels of avyakta. One is the avyakta that the samsara goes into, unmanifest condition, and then the samsara comes out. The universe goes into it, unmanifest, there's that avyakta. And then there's the avyakta, which is the atma, that is the more of a padama avyakta. It's talked about in the Mundaka Upanishad, where the self is never comes into manifestation. See, Maya manifests and goes into unmanifest, manifests, unmanifests. But Atma is always avyakta. The self never becomes object, it's not objectifiable.
So it's
self-evident.
It's the definition is contextual then.
Yeah. In the Mundaka Upanishad, in the first few verses actually, there's a verse that talks about the two avyaktas. In one verse, the avyakta of the samsara of the maya, which is held by the avyakta, which is the atma. Yeah. But literally just means unmanifest. Vyakta is manifest. Right?
So that's basically, like, you see that in as thought. I mean, I still get confused.
What do you mean? To see what?
Well, I mean, I think the other day you said this is just one big thought.
Oh.
Meaning, but you didn't mean Ishwar, I don't think. I mean, what you meant was from the jiva standpoint. Like.
Oh, yeah. It's true. I don't remember saying with those words, but if, say, like with your eyes and your sense organs are open now, and then this is a vritti, it's a thought, and that this thought is including your, because through your, just the sensory perception includes your body, right?
Mm.
So this is one thought that is inclusive of the body, which is pervaded by awareness.
Yeah.
Like if I ask you to imagine a meadow, like I use the meadow again, if you imagine a meadow, it's easy for you to say, oh, the whole thing is pervaded by awareness. It's a thought, right? The meadow, yeah, have a meadow thought, please. So you have a meadow thought. Whole thought is pervaded by awareness, sustained by awareness, and the thought resolves into awareness. This is a thought. It's exactly the same thing. This thought is pervaded by awareness, is sustained by awareness, and resolves into awareness. So, but now, when I say this is a thought, what is really happening is your sense organs are feeding into the mind, you know? So the mind utilizes the sense organs to perceive. So this room is being perceived right now through your sense organs. But the sense organs funnel into the mind, creating an antakarana vritti, a thought modification, right? A thought, which is then I'm aware of. The consciousness illumines the thought. It doesn't illumine part of the thought. It illumines everything in the thought. Including this body. This body is part of the thought that is being perceived through my sense perception. So in terms of awareness illumining the thought, there's no difference between awareness illumining a thought, even though the thought is originating right now from sense perception, Or awareness illumining a thought like a meta imagination. It's still a thought, and awareness still illumines, it pervades, and is the substrate being of that thought.
You know, the other day you said something to Edward, like, or else, if he was talking about the body, or I don't know, and then he said, well, otherwise it's like consciousness is just a little bubble trapped in a body or something. You know, if you don't see it this other way, then that's what you end up with. And so, I mean, I still have this problem, because it's kind of like I think of the thoughts of being in my mind, and my mind being in my head.
Right.
And then the book is over there. But so the recognition is that that book, Passport Reality, consciousness itself, but I only know that as a thought. But so I still think like somehow the book is over there and the awareness is over here.
So but, you know, the, but yeah, but the book is over there,
yeah,
and the awareness over there, mm, from the standpoint of your body, mm, right? But that's why, you know, when we do the see or seeing differentiation, you're putting more,
yeah,
and more into the,
right,
creation.
Right.
So then you see that the self is actually liberated.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, consciousness, the self is illumining the subject and the object.
The subject being what?
You with your mind and sense organs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's illumining the subject and the object. But the mind and the sense organs are what are giving you knowledge of. That's where the thought is taking place. So I don't know, there's just something, I'm so confused about it.
Well, you have to, I understand it, but, okay, let's go back to the meadow for a minute. Mm-hmm. When you imagine a meadow, and there's people in the meadow, in the imagination, and those people have minds, and they're looking around at the trees and talking to each other, mm-hmm, they have sense organs and minds and thoughts, and they have a life. The meadow life, okay? These people are all living there in the meadow, engaging with each other. Okay, now, from the standpoint of the one character in the meadow, her perception is coming from the standpoint of the body with the sense organs and the mind, right? But that mind reflects awareness, right? Where is the awareness?
It pervades the whole thing.
It pervades the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to get to that position to where you see that even though within the meadow, within this room, mm-hmm, there's this dimension and, you know, the painting is 10 feet from me. Mm-hmm. Awareness isn't 10 feet from me. And actually then you start realizing that the whole thing is in awareness.
Mm-hmm.
This body, mind, sense organs with the eyes and the mind and everything is as much in awareness as whatever it's perceiving.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to break the awareness loose, mm-hmm, in order to make that shift.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's why this knowledge takes some. It's a big thing,
mm-hmm,
to make that shift.
It's kind of dense material. I mean, the wiring is dense, that's what I mean.
Absolutely. The wiring of this jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, is meant to experience this world. That's what this upadhi, that's what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
It's to experience this world.
It's default.
Yeah. So, the Upanishads, that's why the Upanishads, to take you from this point,
mm-hmm,
to give more and more of this over to Ishwara,
mm-hmm,
and release the awareness. Give this all to Ishwara, release the awareness, then the awareness is the one that illumines the whole creation. And this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishwara, belongs to Ishwara.
Right.
So if the mind lights up the senses and the body.
And the sense organs light up the body.
Oh, yeah, okay. Thing. But didn't you used to say that, like, the Buddha lights up the mind?
You can say that. In fact, I don't really say that the Buddha lights up the mind, but actually, the Buddha is the one that can have control over the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the buddhi is interior to the mind. You know, even though it's they're both vrittis, that
yes.
the buddhi is interior to the mind and controls the mind.
So making them both vrittis is the mind, really.
Yeah, and but in the end, you see the whether it's the manas, the mind that's being illumined, or the buddhi that's being illumined, or the ahankara, the I notion that's being illumined. Those are all different types of vrittis. Who is the luminary? Who's doing the illumining? And because the thoughts go on changing and changing and changing, and they change and change and change within awareness, which isn't changing at all. That's the subject. That's the self. And that self can't join in this seer-seeing differentiation. Once you get to the self, you can't objectify it. Where there's a self aware of a self, as though, you know, the self is self-aware because it's awareness, not because there's a subject-object relationship. It's self-evident, you know. But everything else requires, it needs to be illumined.
I thought the seer-seeing differentiation was getting, the seer is ultimately seen to be the self.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
Oh, what did I say? Or what did you hear?
I heard you say the self couldn't participate in that or something.
No, in the end it can't be objectified. When you get to the subject, it can no longer be objectified.
Right.
And yet it is known because it's self-evident, not because there's a subject-object. You know, like the sun doesn't have to bring in another sun to light it up. It is its own luminosity. So consciousness is consciousness. But that's why we say it's self-evident. It doesn't require a mind or... Consciousness doesn't require a mind or buddhi or anything, but the buddhi requires it. That's again the satya mitya. Mm. Yeah. Should we call it a night?
Have a good trip, right? And have a nice birthday. It's your birthday.
I know, my niece is getting married on my birthday. And so we'll be sharing that for
a big party and cake and everything.
Big beautiful wedding cake just for me.
And you'll be back Sunday night, is that?
I'll be back, so not for class.
No. For yourself.
What? Thanks. Time to get back. We're going to wait a minute.
There's a lot of territory. Just about everything.
Thank you. Thank you.
So are they going up there?
Hmm?
How are things?
I started to do a Surya Namaskar practice, like 48 every day.
Really?
Just like my age. And I really feel like it's just moving something else. So. It's a really deep, I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, it just kind of came through when we started the chanting. They both lined up, so.
Yeah, you do the chanting first, and then the Surya Namaskar.
No, I'm going to, I normally do it sunrise, the Surya Namaskar.
I see.
At 6:20,
yeah.
And then by 7:30 I'm done.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it takes only like 35 minutes or so
yeah.
to do 48.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's definitely moves to you.
Yeah.
It's great. I feel so open. I mean, body-wise, it's a great feeling.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I used to do that. I don't even remember how to do it now.